Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Mayor Triple Threat, the four-tool mayor with the biggest joint in town, she has some allies.
Oh, she does
have some allies.
Really?
Just when you think she doesn't have any allies, she's on an island, and no man is an island. She does have allies. They're the estrogen junkies on The View, and they rallied in part to her defense. Really, Whoopi rallied to her defense on The View yesterday, her defense rallied to her defense in response to the criticism she received for her call to arms tweet in response to the leaked draft opinion on the Dobbs case. Here's what Whoopi said.
I think that Lori, when she says a call to arms, that's something we in the 60s know what that means. That doesn't mean to go and do any fight. That means to pay attention and make sure you're there voting, doing what you need to
and
do.
I think,
right.
You know,
tune in, turn on, drop out, whatever the kids in the 60s were chanting. Yeah, so that was just her way of saying engage. It wasn't a call to violence, of course, turbulent times. Something else on The View, though. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. If you'd like to buttress Whoopi's defense of Triple Threat, happy to hear it. One of the other man-hating shrews on that panel, fungible, don't know who she is, don't care. Here's something she said as these magpies were kicking this topic around, as the gals are wont to do.
I just laughed because, as far as we know, there has been no one that crossed the line in peaceful assembly and protest.
That was yesterday.
There's, as far as we know, there's been nobody who's crossed the line in peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm.
Which protest do you want to start with, Dan?
Well, how about the Molotov cocktail arsoning of the Wisconsin Family Action Office in Madison? Is that across the line? Is that a peaceful protest? Oh, and by the way, the Wisconsin Family Action Office released some of the voicemails they've received from the enlightened Save Our Democracy Corps of the left. Here's what some of the messages they received were. This is after news got around that there was an attempted arson at their place of business.
Hi, I'm calling because I read about the fire in your building, and I'm calling because I'm curious if it was arson or rather the good Lord showing you an example of hell and where you belong for being such a misogynistic bitch. Thanks for basically going out there daily and making sure that women can't have control over their own bodies. And I'm so thankful that the good Lord finally took action on people like you.
You're going to burn as well. You're all going to burn. You f-ing think you're following the will of f-ing Jesus? You're following the f-ing devil, actually. You're just evil little f-ing people try to control other people's lives. F-ing next time that f-ing Molotov, I hope it f-ing doesn't and miss. I hope you all burn with it. That's what you deserve.
Yeah, you must be a pretty perverted group if that's all you got to do all day long is think about people's sex organs. Leave your f***ing beliefs out of the government. You got no rights to be prying into other people's private family matters. Get the f*** out and keep your f***ing sh- to yourself, you f***ing idiots. We sick of you f***ing evangelical pieces of shit. Go to hell. That's where you're going anyway.
Yeah, just learned about you ignorant, simple, sick, waste of scum because of the fire. And whoever set that fire is a true American patriot. You people are just utter filth of the planet. And it's too bad your whore mothers didn't abort each and every last one of you.
Dude, stop.
Hopefully you all get cancer, suffer out there, and dead before the end of the year. For the betterment of all of humanity, you self-absorbed waste of human scum and filth.
Burn, little Jesus freaks. Burn, burn, burn.
Yeah, hey, I just heard about your fire, and I'm toasting to that. Like, you f***ing pieces of shit couldn't deserve any less. I really hope you all f***ing have to live with the evil that you've dispensed in the world. F*** you, you f***ing pieces of shit. Enjoy your marshmallows.
So I hear you had a little bit of trouble.
This is psychotic.
Oh, well. Oh, well. He'll rebuild.
That's the Save Our Democracy crew offering their condolences on the attempted arson at the Wisconsin Family Action Office over the weekend.
And
mostly,
I thought...
Mostly peaceful protests.
I thought the writing on the wall on the outside was bad. I mean, those people are psychotic. So like they're... They sound like they should be going straight to the doctor, if you know what I mean.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
So if you live there, you're going to have to, or work there, you're going to have to live in fear the whole time. I mean, they wrote, if abortions aren't safe, then you aren't either.
Yeah, well, the staff of the Wisconsin Family Action, this pro-life organization out there, they're used to the threats. And the whataboutism of the left on this, too, you know, the comparing what's happened over the weekend favorably to January 6th and trying to present false equivalences on the topic really speak to the coddling of violence and the violent that the left does, whether it's with respect to law enforcement or with respect to political action or the intersection of the two, a la Black Lives Matter in the summer of 2020 and since. And what you're seeing right now is, again, an anatomy of how the left operates. This could be abortion. It could be reparations, racial justice, however they define it, as we saw in the summer of 2020. It can be any topic.
It could be climate change.
It can be climate change. This is their playbook.
This could be transgenders in sports.
John in Willowbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, well, they talk about constantly controlling my body. What about controlling your own body by taking birth control or the men wearing condom? What happened to after the morning pill? Okay. How about a video showing a child being, you know, aborted, with all their arms and legs together, and the blood. I think then the people will turn around and see what the heck is going on. Thank you.
All right, John. Vince Waukegan. Hey, Vince.
Hey, guys.
You're on.
Yeah, I'm thinking that maybe some of those phone calls might lead you to some of the arsons.
Well, police in Madison are investigating a group called Jane's Revenge. Mm-hmm. Right now, that's according to Fox News. And they've set places on fire before.
Thanks for the call, Vince.
Organization buildings.
It's a mostly peaceful organization, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, real peace.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy, and hey, thank you for taking my call. I'll start off with the punchline. These rotten, murderous people, like leftist socialists, they've been getting away with murder for a long time. Literally. They love it. It's a little bit different than all these other things, because this is really, really serious to these people because of just how evil they are. And you can tell by those voicemails that you have and everything. These are evil, rotten people, which we already knew. But this has really got them unhinged and really messed up in the head, because they're losing this power to kill innocents is what it's about.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it. Carl, Southern Indiana.
Yeah, left likes to call it a fetus. I would like to pose a question to the view that ask Whoopi if a man shoots a pregnant woman, how is it the state charges him with double murder if she's pregnant? Isn't that the state saying it is a baby?
Oh, yeah.
I think that should be used in future, I don't know, when they try and fight the whether it's a baby or not. Cause that's going to be the state saying it is a baby. That's full out cases because it's been done.
It's Thanks, so Carl. Hypocritical, and we've covered so many stories where the pregnant woman has been shot, and he's charged with a double murder.
Well, on the anatomy of the left, former Attorney General Bill Barr was on with Jesse Waters. And he had this to say, sort of a lot, you know, all the whataboutism and, you know, exposing the left's hypocrisy. It's so easy to do, but it doesn't quite provide the whole picture of what's happening. Yeah, right. Merrick Garland is worried about people protesting at a school, public school board meeting, but he's not worried about people protesting outside the homes of justices and all that. We'll get to that. But I want you to think globally about this because it's bigger than just the abortion issue. It's every issue. It's the left's approach. And here's Bill Barr's distillation on that, which is pretty good.
You know, they've been using violence as a political tool, and it's been seeping into our system. It started with all the attacks on Trump supporters early in the campaign in the spring of 2016. You'll remember there were a whole series of attacks in Costa Mesa and San Jose and Albuquerque and so forth. And it just kept on going. That was perfectly fine to go and beat up Trump supporters at political rallies. That was the insinuation of politics and the whole rhetoric of resistance. Suggests that the government is not a legitimate government. Anything goes, and that's essentially what the left is all about. Anything goes because, you know, they're holy, they're virtuous, and they know what they're leading history. They're the vanguard of history, and they know what's best for everyone. So if you oppose them, if you get in their way, you can be rolled over. The ends justify the means, and this is the ultimate expression of it.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Elon Musk gave an interview to the Financial Times yesterday in which he was asked if and when he does gain control of Twitter, what will the fate of one President Trump be? I know Trump has said that he's not coming back to Twitter, even if he's invited, because he's got Truth Social. Makes sense. He's got his own platform. He wants people to focus their attention on his platform, join his platform, not Jack Dorsey's or Elon Musk's platform. But here's what Musk had to say, not just about unbanning Trump, but more generally about discourse on social media platforms, starting with Twitter.
I do think that it was not correct to ban Donald Trump. I think that was a mistake because it alienated a large part of the country and did not ultimately result in Donald Trump not having a voice. He is now going to be on Truth Social, as will a large part of the sort of the right in the United States, and so I think this could end up being frankly worse than having a single forum where everyone can debate. I guess the answer is that I would reverse the perma ban. Obviously, I don't own Twitter yet, so this is not like a thing that will definitely happen, because what if I don't own Twitter? But my opinion, and Jack Dorsey, I want to be clear, shares this opinion, is that we should not have perma bans. Now that doesn't mean that somebody gets to say whatever they want to say. If they say something that is illegal or otherwise, you know, just destructive to the world, then that there should be perhaps a timeout, a temporary suspension, or that particular tweet should be made invisible or have very limited traction. But I think perma bans just fundamentally undermine trust in Twitter as a town square where everyone can voice their opinion.
For those who left Twitter with when Trump got banned, or when Alex Berenson got banned, or so many other people, is that good enough for you to come back if Musk is able to gain control and lives up to his word? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
When they kicked President Trump off, I don't know about you, but I lost thousands of followers that just dropped off of Twitter because they felt alienated, you know, because the fact that they took away Trump and his voice. And, you know, I was horrified because there's dictators in this world who are still allowed to be on Twitter, but yet President Trump couldn't. And President Trump, I don't care what he says, his social media, he has 2 million on that. What's it called? Truth Social?
Yeah, Truth yeah. Social.
He will come back to Twitter. I mean, I think he has to. And I'd like to know if you think so, too. I think he has to if he's going to run for president in 2024. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Why does he have to?
Because it's a large social media platform. It's what helped get him. It's a vehicle he used to help become president in 2020.
It's a vehicle he used to help become president, but does he need it in 20? I mean, that was 2016, by the way.
Oh, sorry, 2016.
Does he need it 8 years later? Trump's in a very different place than he was in 2016, isn't he? I'm not saying it's not useful.
It's free advertising.
It's not even advertising. It's useful to get around the D.C. press corps and deliver messages directly. That's the utility of it. And that's how Trump used it, much to his advantage in 2016 and throughout his presidency. But does he really need it now? And one thing I will take issue with what Musk said, and I understand his perspective, he's a suitor of Twitter. Mm-hmm. But the idea, he's like, he said, you know, he'll be on, he's got Truth Social, and potentially that's more destructive than having one open forum for discourse. No, I don't think so. I don't know what is going to come of Truth Social, but it's not about Truth Social versus Twitter. It's just about platforms and civil discourse writ large. Well, why? Why does it? He wants it to be Twitter. And if I was in his position, I'd be saying the same thing. I want this to be the primary preeminent free marketplace of ideas. That's our value proposition. That's how we're going to brand it. That's how we're going to operate it, because that's going to attract the most people. And for those who can't tolerate divergent views, well, then you don't have to participate. But we're going to err on the side of those who can tolerate divergent views, who do want to debate the issues of the day and share information and the like. But I don't think it needs, I don't think it's mutually exclusive. Twitter has to be the preeminent free exchange platform. Because otherwise, if you have a Twitter and you have a Truth Social and you have a Parler and so on and so forth, and we have these siloed conversations, number one, you can participate in more than one forum.
True.
And number two, you know, every forum presents a different dynamic. And so that is the definition of a free marketplace of ideas, is you have different groups that have built different mousetraps in which there's some overlap and there's some different people in those respective communities. So what's wrong with that? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
CNN would benefit if President Trump was back on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, they spend time every day. It was like breaking news if President Trump tweeted something.
He was a copywriter for CNN. They would just take his tweets and that would be their news reporting.
Yeah, it'd be a whole segment.
Cindy and Niles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. I went back to Twitter the day that it was announced Elon bought Twitter. And within the first day, I was knocked off. A group of us were on a thread following each other back. And I don't know if they thought I was a bot or whatever, but they kicked me out. And I said, that I'm not going back if Trump comes back or anything. I want nothing to do with Twitter anymore.
All right. Thanks.
It's estimated that 340 million users by 2024. For Twitter. Right now it's about 290 million. That's better than 2 million if you want to get your message out.
Yeah, but it's also driven by a very small group of people. It's a very small subset that drives it. And you look at what the average number of followers is for somebody who has a Twitter account, it's very small. And it doesn't mean that the opinions of somebody that has less followers are less important. It just means, and Elon Musk made this point, even some of the people with the most Twitter followers are the least active on Twitter, the celebrities that have followers just because they're a celebrity. Well, so what are they contributing to the platform? It was one of the points that Musk made in sort of assessing how Twitter operates. And I think it's a good one. You know, it's not the personality, it's the content. That's the product. And that's the value of Twitter. So if you're not providing content, then you're not really adding value to Twitter, is his point. And it's right. That's right. Just like if we're having a conversation and you're not participating in it, then you're not adding much value, are you? Same deal.
You can be listening and learning.
Well, yeah, okay, but...
Like, I learned a lot from Alex Berenson, and I'm pissed that he's not on Twitter.
You're gaining value. You're not adding value. You're not adding to the discussion. I get it. You can, and that's fine. You can be a bystander, and you can learn, or you can just follow the people. Whatever. I mean, we're not mandating anybody do anything. We're just, you know, sort of understanding, discussing these platforms, the ethos of these platforms, and perhaps what we should want to see. I mean, I think Musk is generally directionally correct, and I hope he gains control of Twitter, and I hope acts in furtherance of what he said so far. Randy and Sandwich.
Guys, we're really overthinking this here because this has already been invented on the show The Office with Ryan Howard, where he had Wolf, where it sends out to all your socials, email, text, fax machine at the same time.
Thanks, Randy. Jim, Crown Point.
We should have more sites where you can go to and express your opinion, not less, because you have what you have now, the few controlling the many. It's not a good thing. Elon Musk is basically breaking it open, and I hope that encourages other sites where we can go to.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for the call. Right. You want social media platforms to compete for those who add value with their content. Right. Competition produces better goods and services at lower costs. Well, that includes in the social media space, too. And you see displacement happening all the time as people migrate from Facebook to Instagram to TikTok.
You're so hip. I mean, look at you.
It's not even a hip thing because I really only use
Snapchat next?
Twitter and Facebook. But
now you're on Instagram too.
Well, yeah, but
we called the gram.
I don't use it that much, but I mean, you look at it as any industry or as any sort of it's a communication. It's part of the communication industry. So you look at it from that perspective.
Are you on Parler? I'm checking my Parler right now. I haven't been on.
You know, I was initially when they got deplatformed, but before they got deplatformed, and then I still have an account there. But this is an example of what I'm talking about. I appreciate that Parler, put a stake in the ground for free exchange of ideas. They anti-Twitter initially, and I appreciate that it provides a little bit more bandwidth in terms of, you know, the number of words you can use in a in a posting and so forth. But it's just not as user friendly as Twitter.
I just hit P for Parler and I went to Portillo's. So it's been that long since I've used that app on my phone.
You know. So this is the building the best mousetrap. And the other thing, too, is you've got to be able to attract people that want to engage in discourse. And I'm not so interested in just an echo chamber. So, you know, that necessarily includes some voices on the left. You know, I want to be in an arena where you're doing an electoral battle. And that's just less so the case on Parler. It's something that any conservative platform needs to figure out, which is why they're so freaked out about Twitter, because that's where they are. And as we noted from David Mamet's observations a couple weeks ago when he was on with Adam Carolla, the left doesn't want to be excluded from spaces that they dominate or where they're influential or that they think are their own. That's why the hysteria over Twitter and not so much concern about competitors to Twitter like Parler. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, guys. Did you get my friend request yesterday? Amy, we have you're not on Facebook anymore quite much, guys, right?
I'm on Facebook, but I only do like puppies and kids news.
Oh, okay, so I won't go back to that. Trump doesn't need it. I don't think Trump needs it. I think he should just stick to his own platform. And, you know, when I got on Twitter.
Investors would prefer that, too.
Yeah, probably. And I got on Twitter so late. You know, I don't like the tech stuff so much, but I need the information. So I got on and I read, and I got all the followers, and then I started to, you know, I called everybody, all the news, all the Chicago people, Lightfoot, everybody. And then that gets kind of like time-consuming, you know, because I can't just scroll all day. And then what did I do? I got off when when Trump got kicked off. Then I got back on. My only follower for, you know, 6 months was John Anthony. He's the only follower because I don't know how to, like, attract people. And you know what? I really don't care except for the people that I want. So now I think I do. And, Amy, you've been telling me for 6 months you're going to follow me. So will you please do that today?
Please, on please Twitter? Make her day. Thanks for the call.
Twitter, make my day.
Well, text me your thing. She could have free.
Mary,
she had more than one follower. She could have been 10.
She's friended you on Facebook.
I don't know how
she's
to do
asked
that.
Politely for you to follow her.
On Twitter.
I mean, what does she have to do to get your attention? David and Winneka.
Yeah, hey, good morning, guys. So you mentioned engaging with left intellectual debate, which I would love to. I seem to run into nothing but thinking with emotion, and I'm wondering how you bring the intelligence out. You have a secret formula.
Yeah, well, that is a fair point. It's not as easy as I'm making it sound. I concede your underlying point there, David. You know, there's some of that that happens. Some of that is still on blogs, too. Marginal Revolution, Tyler Cohen, and Alex Tabarek's blog is a good example of that. Even like between the conservatives and libertarians, places like Cafe Hayek are pretty good. But you have to pick the people you want to engage with. You sort of, if somebody is typing in all caps and hysterical and with every offering, you know, like Robert Reich, former labor secretary, people like that. Well, then you know there's no chance of any sort of substantive discourse. But I've had some back and forths that are interesting on topic. I agree. It's increasingly difficult to find, though. But, you know, it's a big wide world out there. I find actually like some regular people that don't have any sort of profile or CV they're leading with on social media where they're not playing to an audience. They actually want to debate the issue. There are some opportunities there, much less so with the blue check mafia. I concede that point.
Hey, I'm Wolf.
I'm Facebook.
What's up, Facebook?
I sent you a Facebook message yesterday. I still haven't heard anything back.
You should have sent me a Wolf.
A what?
When you send a Wolf, it goes to your home phone, cell phone, email, Facebook, Twitter, and home screen all at the same time.
Wolf.com.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Captain Kangaroo, the Treasury Secretary, was on the Hill yesterday being queried by senators. Query by some, prompted by others.
It's such a great analogy, though, of Captain Kangaroo.
Captain Kangaroo. Have you ever seen the two in the same place?
No.
Exactly. Yellen was prompted by the good senator from New Jersey, Bob Menendez, on the abortion issue. Remember we started off the show, anatomy of a leftist political purge. You call it campaign, I call it purge. So you've got the paid purveyors of disorder in front of the homes of Supreme Court justices. You've got your D.C. press corps on overdrive. And then you send out all of your ambassadors, if you will, from the administration in every venue even the Treasury Secretary.
I know.
To talk about abortion.
Why in God's name was she talking about abortion?
Because that's what they do. Everything gets shoehorned into whatever the immediate moral panic is, the immediate political opportunity they think they can seize, and they're over-rotating, which is what the left does. Way over-rotating. And this is a good example of it. Janet Yellen, being prompted by Bob Menendez as to how abortion impacts our economy. The economics of abortion from Captain Kangaroo here.
So, Secretary Yellen, if the draft of the court's majority holding in Roe versus Wade is the actual decision, what impact will the loss of abortion access mean economically for women?
Well, I believe that eliminating the right of women to make decisions about when and whether to have children would have very damaging effects on the economy and would set women back decades. Roe v. Wade and access to reproductive health care, including abortion, helped lead to increased labor force participation. It enabled many women to finish school. That increased their earning potential. It allowed women to plan and balance their families and careers. And research also shows that it had a favorable impact on the well-being and earnings of children. There are many research studies that have been done over the years looking at the economic impacts of access or lack thereof to abortion, and it makes clear that denying women access to abortion increase their odds of living in poverty or need for public assistance.
Yeah, so woman is just economic woman in Janet Yellen's world. The highest, greatest good is bumping up the labor participation rate. That's why we're here.
Yeah, we're here. I'm here to help the economy and the labor force participation rate, Dan. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah. And I don't know if you can do both. You can be a mother and that, and abortion is...
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
So what she's saying there is that if I have children, I can't work. Well, can you be a working mother?
Having children hurts women economically, particularly unless they have a certain income level, is essentially what she's saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm appalled by that statement.
Senator Tim Scott followed up on what you just heard from the captain and sought a little bit of clarity, offered his own perspective. This is how that exchange went.
I'm just surprised that we find ways to weave into every facet of our lives such an important and painful reality for so many people to make it sound like it's just another 0.4% added to our labor force participation as a result of the issue of abortion just, to me, seems harsh.
Well, I certainly don't mean to say what I think the effects are in a manner that's harsh. What we're talking about is whether or not women will have the ability to regulate their reproductive situation in ways that will enable them to plan lives that are fulfilling and satisfying for them. And one aspect of a satisfying life is being able to feel that you have the financial resources to raise a child, that the children you bring into the world are wanted, and that you have the ability to take care of them. In many cases, abortions are of teenage women, particularly low income and often black, who aren't in a position to be able to care for children, have unexpected pregnancies, and it deprives them of the ability often to continue their education, to later participate in the workforce. So there is a spillover into labor force participation, but It means that children will grow up in poverty and do worse themselves.
Thank
and
you. Let me just say my time
harsh.
On the topic.
This is the truth.
I'll just simply say that as a guy raised by a black woman in abject poverty, I'm thankful to be here as United States Senator.
Oh, God bless him. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
So, Captain Kangaroo, just to follow up on that. So, women being able to feel they can comfortably, that they have the resources to comfortably raise children. So, what if they start out with the resources to comfortably raise children, and then they or the family takes an economic hit, and then raising children becomes a lot more difficult than they originally conceived it would be because they were doing well at one point,
right?
And they weren't doing so well.
Everyone, that's happened to all of us.
So, to
stop it, Dan, I should remain childless to better serve the economic machine.
Well, no. What about a post-birth abortion then?
Oh, right. I mean, just off them, or do we just drop them off in a mail slot at the firehouse?
Well, based on economic necessity.
Box? Yeah.
Because I don't want to negatively impact a woman. Man, a family who suffered an economic downturn, and now they've got these children.
Well, these things, I mean, these accessories.
And now I can't go back to school because I've got these children. I'm worried about being able to make ends meet because I've got these children. So what do? You jettison the children, right?
She's underestimating what women can do in that statement.
But
yeah, you can't have kids and go to finish your college career. Yeah, you can. It's called a gap year.
What is the philosophy?
Yeah.
What is possible? What is the philosophy being advanced here?
312-642-5600.
Ralph Rantoul.
Good morning. I think that's the perfect moniker for pro-life women who discard all this nonsense like Yellen just spewed out. They could call themselves labor force because, you know, pregnant women go into labor. Hey, you know, talking about unplanned pregnancies, I used to work with a woman named Diane, ran away from home, unplanned pregnancy, pretty much like her first night when she ran away from home. She raised that baby. She put herself through University of Wisconsin, waiting tables with an infant, took the kid to class with her, got her bachelor degree in chemistry, went out, started working. She was a teenager with an unplanned pregnancy who went on and had a fantastic career. I worked with her for many years. So what Yellen says is a bunch of crap. It's what you want to do. You know, she made a huge mistake. She didn't kill the baby. She had that baby and raised him and had a career and got an education. So, you know, fie on all those people who say it's not possible.
Well, I mean, it's just demoralizing that she thinks women can't do it all, that we can't go to school and have a baby and go to work and still, you know, have children.
Yeah, so if it's inconvenient, just kill your children.
Right.
I mean, that's the moral of the story.
There you go.
Exactly like Dan was saying.
Yep. That's what they're promoting.
Thanks for the call, Ralph.
They're promoting abortions.
Well, the other thing, too, is it presumes, and if the left is nothing, it's nothing else, it's presumptuous. It presumes you know how things work out. You look at some statistics and you sort of, holding everything else equal, say, well, the probability is this, and so this should be the outcome, you know, out of an abundance of caution.
Oh, there you go. Thank you.
To prevent another family from living in poverty. And of course, there's no discussion of the front end, which is if you never want to live in poverty.
Do three things. Graduate from high school.
Four.
I have the blonde version. You have the real version.
Graduate
from high school. Be married before you have children.
Yeah.
Listen to Dan Proft every day.
Well, that's five, but okay.
I'm the other two. I can't remember. Sorry.
Don't commit a crime.
Don't commit a crime.
And get a job. Any job.
Any job.
Burger flipper. Get any job. Sweeping up somewhere. Whatever. Yep. Get a job. Get into the labor force. You want to never live in poverty? There's a 99% chance. Get a job, graduate high school, don't commit a crime, don't have children until you're married. Do we want to talk about that in terms of choices and what negatively impacts the life's path and so forth? No, of course we don't. Because it's anything goes, and then the government is here to provide you a way out of the predicament you put yourself in. And the way out usually involves somebody dying or somebody paying your tab. And they call that sound public policy. Or they call that, you know, respecting women's reproductive rights. It's, I mean, it's always couched in this noble language, isn't it? The noblesse oblige of the left never disappoints. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Well, impoverished. Janet Yellen is impoverished intellectually. She's probably never read a book of somebody that she doesn't agree with, in my opinion. But this reminds me of the Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon debate.
Population bomb.
That bet. Yeah, I mean, you know, is a life a mind to create or is it a mouth to feed? And that's evidently what the left thinks of it. You know, we think of it as a mind to create. I mean, you can go through history. There's countless people that were impoverished that became great people and contributed to our civilization and society and made great advances and so forth. These people are Maoists. I'm waiting for them to come out and just ask people to start killing themselves, like they did during the Great Leap Forward in the Cultural Revolution. There were millions of people in China who just killed themselves because of what was happening in their country and to their traditions and to their civilization. So waiting for that to happen from these idiots.
Thanks for the call, Frank. I mean, Tim Scott just provided an example right there, right?
I loved it. I mean, it was right in your face.
Yeah, I'm sure glad my mom, who lived in poverty, single mom, raised me, you know, much like J.B. Pritzker, raised by a single mom. Tim Scott, raised by a single mom. Lived in poverty. I'm glad I'm here. I mean, there's so many stories like this. So many stories. This is no chance, and it turns out to be the child turns out to have had a massive positive impact on the world. Like, I don't know, Beethoven. I mean, you know the story of Beethoven's mom. And her seven kids and her sickliness and living in poverty. I don't know if she's going to be able to participate in the workforce. You better get rid of Ludwig.
I mean, she was basically telling Senator Scott that his mom should have aborted him, if you think about it.
Lisa in Johnsburg.
Hi, guys. If she's so worried about the workforce, I'm wondering what the next generation will be if all the babies are aborted. Who's going to pick up the tab?
Well, we aren't here in Chicago because we're an oasis for abortion.
Well, I mean, we have stagnating birth rates, right? The West in general are in demographic death spirals to varying degrees. This has been the case for some time, and it's increased during the pandemic. It's not good news. When did this idea of women as mothers, when did this become a pejorative or a burden that somehow needs to be alleviated by the state? Is that how moms view themselves?
I don't.
These burdens that I have called children. I mean, I understand, I get the day-to-day is not always glamorous. I mean, I get that. But you know what I'm talking about, writ large, big picture. The way that they characterize women and their children and family, doesn't it give you the chills a little bit? Women are supposed to be barren workforce drones. That's the highest, best purpose of being a woman.
And where are men in all this conversation? Like, you know.
Well, the whole thing is the pro abort is the proponent of the Playboy. That's the funniest thing about it. They're great feminists. You're not. Women should behave like whores and men should treat them like whores. That's the position of the pro-abortion movement. Okay, if I can just strip it down and present it in an unvarnished fashion, that's their position. How is it not? Joe in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Another great show. You know, they're shameless. They take the economic downturn that everybody's suffering under and they try to rationalize killing babies. Is there anything they won't try to do to protect their high sacrament of infanticide? I just wonder, now that I've heard that, I can't believe anyone would actually listen to it and think it was sincere. But what are they going to do next? The economy, let's find economic justification for queer theory and critical race theory. That's next.
Thanks for the call. Well, we have the, it's going to be a boon, the additional abortion tourism coming to Illinois if Roe is overturned, because we're the abortion capital of the Midwest. And so with the more restrictive laws of our neighboring states, more women will come here. And then Mayor Triple Threat set up a fund to use our tax dollars to help them underwrite their abortions. That's going to be a boon to Illinois' economy. Isn't that great? Yeah. Because that's all
tourism will be up.
That's all we care about is state revenue and human beings as vassals for revenue generation to the state. Since Janet Yellen was so aggressive in weighing in on this, getting way outside her lane, I would have loved to hear Tim Scott or somebody say, when does life begin? I mean, since you're, opining on this.
And a policymaker.
And a policymaker. Tell us, Captain. Mark Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. First, Dan, I think your Beethoven analogy is going to fall on deaf ears.
Very nice. Yeah.
Well done. Let me make two quick points. One, maybe the problem isn't the need of more abortions. Maybe the answer is we need more husbands. And, because I have an 18-year-old son, and, he's dating, and if he was to get his girlfriend pregnant, I would tell him, you need to get to the chapel. I wouldn't be telling him to get to the clinic, because what this country needs is more faith in God and family and less faith in the federal government, because the government is supposed to be our Uncle Sam, not our sugar daddy.
Thanks, Mark.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Yeah, Oakton Community College, in collaboration with Evanston Township High School.
Oh, boy.
Has launched, or is launching this fall, the Emory Williams Academy for Black Men.
Okay.
Will provide a two-year academic program that culminates in an associate degree, assistance transferring to a four-year university, and other vocational opportunities. The program will also offer financial aid, scholarships, and additional financial resources, according to the website. It is a free degree program for Black male-identifying locals. So when I said black men, the Emory Williams Academy for Black Men should really be for, apparently, the Emory Williams Academy for Black male-identifying locals. You see how this seeps in everywhere? Mm-hmm. Black male-identifying locals. Students will probably be provided or offered academic pathways and fields: computer science, marketing, engineering, accounting, law enforcement, criminal justice, business, and cannabis studies. Oh, that's an academic discipline now. Wonderful. The Emory Williams Academy for Black Male-Identifying Locals. I'm changing it. Just get ahead of it. The value statement there. We advance equity by acknowledging the harm perpetrated against black men, or black male-identifying locals, by systemic racism in all levels of their education and intentionally disrupting it here at the college. The program's exclusion of non-black male-identifying locals does not run afoul of federal guidelines, according to the college, because Oakden is an open access institution to which all students are invited to apply, enroll, and access services. It's just this academy within the community college in collaboration with Evanston Township High School that is black male identifying locals only. I mean, think about that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. You could still go to Oakton College and get your associates if you're a honky, if you're a cracker.
Okay, that's nice.
If you're cisgendered, you can still do that for now. It's just within the college, you have this program that's free, so taxpayer funded. Financial aid, scholarship, additional financial resources, pathways, assistance with getting into a 4-year college and other, the provision of other vocational opportunities. That is only for black male identifying locals. Any problem with that? Mario Borja, he's an Oakton professor and the endowed chair of the Emory Williams Academy for Black Male Identifying Locals. He called it a brotherhood of scholars. By being exposed to a multitude range of identities, of multiple representations of and manifestations of blackness and maleness, male identifying locals, right? They will see that they are unique and that while there are others like them, they will also see that there are others not like them, and they will be able to learn from all those experiences. That is so profound. I'm so impressed by the endowed chair of the Emory Williams Academy for Black Male Identifying Locals.
Male identifying. So if I'm a black female, but I identify as a male, I could be considered for
free
this program.
Degree program for black male identifying locals. What is confusing about that? Did you not hear Mario Borja's rhetorical flourish? By being exposed to a multitude range of identities, of multiple representations of and manifestations of blackness and maleness, they will see that they are unique and that while there are others like them, they will also see that there are others not like them, and they will be able to learn from all those experiences. Wow. Everybody's special? Is that what you're trying to say, Mario? I mean, this is kindergarten stuff, but okay. No, it's serious. This is it's a brotherhood of scholars. You know how I know? Mario Borja told me. He said it right there, brotherhood of scholars. I'm impressed. They're going to be prepared for the real world. Maybe Fortune 500 company. It's about the only places these people with this sort of education can work. And I'm saying these people, meaning these identitarians on college campuses of all stripes, honkies, blacks, Latinos, Asians, whoever is having their gray matter slowly eaten away by identitarian politics. The problem is, while your intersectional score will be off the charts, those Fortune 500 companies, for the most part, in the decision-making positions, if you want to climb the ladder, you're going to have to know some things, you know, basic things, and build on those basic things like math, economics, reading comp, management skills, those sorts of things. And when they're subordinated to all of this celebration of how your uniqueness as a degree program, you may not be quite as prepared as you think you are to climb to the C-suites. We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. First degree, a free degree program for black male identifying locals at Oakton. Within Oakton, again.
Within Oakton, so you already have to be in the college.
No, well, you within the college, so okay. You can go specifically for this program, or if you're just one of your off-the-shelf honkies, then you can go to Oakton for whatever else they have for off-the-shelf honkies. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I have a question. I am white, but if I identify as a black male or a black identified, can I go?
Nice try.
Can anybody today identify as anything they want?
Nice try, Rachel Dolezal. No, let me repeat. Great question. This is a safe space to ask those kind of questions. A free degree program for black male identifying locals.
So, okay.
seems to imply you can't just identify as black. You actually have to be black, but you can just identify as male.
And they said the reason why they're doing this is that the black men stay enrolled at junior college at low levels. So only 35.4% of black male students continue with their second year of junior college as compared to other students, which is near 50%. But maybe they say because maybe they moved on to four-year universities. I mean, there's...
Not after their first year? Doubtful. That's not what's happening. Go talk to community college presidents, university presidents. I've said this for years. It hasn't changed. It's getting worse. You know how they will tell you chapter and verse on how much they have to spend on remediation for their freshmen or their first-year students because they're unprepared for college-level work. Why do they leave?
Most of them come from CPS.
Why do they leave? Because they can't cut it. That's why they leave, for the most part. There are all sorts of other dynamics, economic, family issues. They move to another, whatever. There's all sorts of things. But generally speaking, you know, sort of fundamental problem is they got a terrible K-12 education, and it's not getting any better when they, you know, go to an open enrollment community college to try to get an associate's degree. Playing catch up for their entire academic life because of the terrible job that's being done at the K-12 level. But it's nice they're doing this in conjunction with Evanston Township High School, which is a terrible high school. So we'll pay for this program three or four times over. To what effect? I don't know. I guess to pretend like we're creating a brotherhood of scholars, according to Mario Borja, where they spend all the time navel gazing. We're all black, but we're also, and that's our bond, but we're also all unique. Let's celebrate our blackness and our uniqueness. Frank and Lamont.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, to answer your question, Dan, what happens when they get into corporate America and they're not moved up because they don't have the skills they need? Well, then they simply go to the federal building and file an EEO complaint that they didn't get what they deserved because of their race. I mean, this is an utter travesty.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Frank. Well, that certainly does happen. But I will tell you, for those who think they can just play the racial card all the way up the ladder, and also something else too, find that fulfilling. That's how you want to play the game. That's how you want to go through life, playing that racial power politics. You think that's going to leave you fulfilled and happy with what you accomplished, in quotation marks? It won't. You know, the satisfaction comes from earning something. And that transcends race and all these other identitarian characters.
Well, at UCLA, black students say they need their racially segregated spaces.
Yeah, of course.
To support black Bruins.
The de facto segregation is going on everywhere.
Yeah, they just want to make sure that black students, that the graduations reflect other demographics.
So you think that's the way you're going to play it? Well, okay. Let me tell you, the rubber meets the road at a certain point where real money is on the line. So you'll be tokenized and accommodated and placated, and you may be able to scratch out a pretty decent living doing that, but you're never going to make an important contribution, and you're never going to be perceived as somebody who's influential or important, whose views matter, because everybody knows, even if they won't say it. So go ahead and play the game that way. See how you feel about yourself as you use that as your way to economic independence or something. Again, being led down a primrose path. This is the point that Thomas Sowell made over and over again in his writings, including 30 years ago in Inside American Higher Education. The people that the left is saying they're helping are the people they're hurting. You are not being helped. You think you're being helped because somebody's giving you something or somebody's recognized you. Somebody is celebrating your uniqueness. If you're not being put in a position to learn and earn, then you're not being helped. Joe Naperville.
Dan, I'm going to agree with you 100% on this because you can move up in the corporate world with identitarian politics. Look at the new press secretary that's replacing Psaki. Everybody just kept talking about first African-American, first LBGQ, you know, put your alphabet in. So you can do it, Dan.
Yeah, well.
And what is she going to start already, by the way?
So, political post, Joe. Let's not apples and orange groves. A political post for appearance sake. And yes, you. What did I just say? Yes, you can do it to a certain extent until where real money is on the line or where the real decisions are being made. And how that is going to leave you as you look back on your career path, your life's work. You can play the game that way, but it doesn't end how people think it ends. Yeah, and I get Karine Jean. What's Saki? Was that a merit hire? Come on, politics and government, which is the same thing. It's a whole different sphere. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks, Dan and Amy, for taking my call. You sort of addressed my question I'm going to offer, but how many people are really successful in getting degrees in Black studies? You know, you've mentioned there's a few successes, but overall, I really wonder how many really obtain career.
Well, this isn't Black studies. This is a brotherhood of scholars and all these disciplines that they're suggesting they're going to focus on helping Black male identifying locals. Thanks for the call, Bob. But yeah, of course, women's studies, all these identitarian studies programs, unless you're going to turn around and be an academic in one of those programs at a university, where do you go with that? I guess you can be one of the, you know, minders for the misinformation board at DHS or for some social media platform, but that's about it. You tap out pretty quickly in terms of skill set. Tom in Deer Park.
You know, there's nothing new under the sun, and this Academy for Brotherhood, I'm just curious, Dan and Amy, if it's going to be taught in English, will it be offered bilingually, or shall it be determined you must use the native German?
Thanks for the call, Tom.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we have been following the good work of CPS teacher, math and algebra teacher, chess coach Joseph O'Call for several years now. He was at Earl STEM Academy in Inglewood. Then he moved over to Ella Flagg Young Elementary on the west side of the city. But he was doing incredible work at Earl STEM, and that work continues at Ella Flagg. He and his team, his kids, students, grade school, just participated in a national middle school chess championship that was held April 28th to May 1st in Grapevine, Texas. Here were the achievements. And this is, again, a startup. This is a startup chess program at Ella Flagg like it was at Earl STEM, as I understand it. Seventh place in the Team Blitz chess event. I'm reading from his summary. This is a very tough event because a player is given only 5 minutes to defeat the opponent. The awards were given to the top 15 schools of the nation, and his team finished seventh. Second place in the individual Blitz chess event, our eighth grader, a girl named Aliyah Johnson, won this award. And Aliyah is under foster care because she was a victim of domestic violence when she was 6 years old. Despite the odds she's been facing, she managed to excel in academics and chess. They finished third place out of 48 school teams in the main event of the unrated section. And now they've got another opportunity to play in the New York City Scholastic Chess Championship that's scheduled for May 20th to the 22nd in Brooklyn. And the thing that continues to baffle me is how Joseph O'Call needs to like go out and raise money so these kids can play chess and compete in tournaments. All the money that's spent at CPS
per pupil, you'd think that they'd have some extra, but
for really extracurriculars,
it's hard. You're going to be getting an email soon from
me,
sister, and you better reply.
Yeah,
I want big money.
And by the way, I want to thank my friend Chris Morrow at Home State Bank, that is in Crystal Lake, who helped underwrite the travel and lodging expenses for Joseph O'Call and his team from Ella Flag for this tournament that was held in Grapevine, Texas. There's got to be a way to scale this. There's got to be a way to replicate what O'Call is doing or put him in charge of figuring out how to scale it and provide some funding so it's not hand to mouth for every tournament, for every season. It's ridiculous. And CPS should be embarrassed. But I mean, I
try to embarrass CPS.
It's impossible.
Good luck with that.
That is impossible. Joseph O'Call, CPS math, algebra teacher, and chess coach. Joseph, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Good morning, Dan. And good morning, Amy. Good morning, Chicago. Good morning. And on behalf of the kids, I want to thank you for all the support that you've given to them. Made it possible for the kids to compete and realize their potential, open the door of opportunities for them to shine and realize their worth. Never in their wildest dreams they ever thought that they'd be able to travel and compete. As I said before, give them a chance to shine and they will shine. And these kids, three of them were in foster care and others raised by single parents. So I'm just trying, I was trying to give them that, you know, the opportunity that they'll be able to see.
So, beyond Chicago. I think we all appreciate that. So how are you doing this? How are you taking kids, whether it's in Inglewood or it's on the West Side? They have no exposure to chess for most of them. You're introducing them to chess. I mean, are you like Magnus Carlsen? I mean, do you have some key insights into playing chess? I mean, how are you turning these kids into like budding chess champions, finding so much success so quickly? I mean, it's fantastic. Like I say, we want to replicate it and scale it, as I'm sure you do.
I just look at the, you know, the potential with them, and I see that they have this potential, and I just give them the chance to play. And we meet every day, almost every day, Monday to Thursday after school, and even in the morning, Wednesday and Thursdays, we meet before school. And a number of them really want to play chess. They're serious, and they see that they see chess as a tool to be able to improve their lives. And I think that's what's most important to them, be able to think critically, to be able to analyze things, and to be able to weigh the consequences. I've said this to them many times, to the students, that just like in life, chess can be used as a tool to weigh every move, make your move, make your best move, and you'll be able to weigh the consequences of the move that you're going to take. And just like in life. So chess is really about life. It's not just about just a game. So I try to do my best to be able to coach them. And that's my main goal, to be able to coach and not really to raise money. It's not really, if there are people who would want to support, and I thank you so much for all the support that you provided these kids. I appreciate that very much.
But how did you?
I'm there as a coach and as a mentor for them.
Yeah, Joseph O'Call, CPS math and algebra teacher, and chess coach. That's who we're speaking with. How did you convince them to join your team, though? Because that's hard to build a team and to get people to play. Did you sit down and show them the game, or how did you do it?
Right now, actually, I have more than 40 kids in our school. They come, and I do a campaigning. I also call the parents. I invite the parents even to come. And there are even parents would come and would try to play with the kids. And I encouraged the kids to be able to spend after school with us. And since I also teach math, I teach algebra, and there are kids who come, play chess at the same time, ask my help about their homework, about their assignments in math. And I combine both. I try to be both teacher, math teacher, and a chess coach. So
are you making the chess team cool in the school?
Yeah,
like with
like
the
it.
Success that these kids have found that are on the team? Are other kids getting word of it and getting interested?
I try to make chess a fun activity for them. I want them to enjoy. I want them to, no pressure at all. Just want them to enjoy. And, you know, these kids, most of them, 95% of our school population, student population, belong to below poverty levels, families. And I try to make an impact in their lives and make a difference in their lives. I try to touch their lives and try to see how I can be of help. Of course, there are a lot of challenges. There are occasions when I even have to be the one to spend on my own. One way or the other, I'm just thankful that there are people who try to support us. I know the school has no budget. I know CPS is also facing financial problems, but my own little way.
I don't know how. I don't know how they're facing.
They were throwing so much money during COVID.
I mean, good grief! Yeah, right. They can't afford a chess. How many? Do you have any idea how many chess programs, chess teams are there in CPS? Do you know?
Oh, we were able to compete in the recently May 3rd in the Cubs and Kids culmination event. And our kids, about 10 of them, won individual trophies. I guess we are the most number of our trophies that were won. So far, there were 12 that I would say there were about 12 school teams that competed. But count the number of school teams in high school and a combination of elementary schools, there are more than, I would guess, more than 50 schools that are.
Well, 50 out of what, 350? I mean, so there's only, but at the grade school level where you're at, there's only a dozen or so teams in the system, as far as you understand it.
Yes, mm-hmm. I would say about the most is about 20.
Do you know if any of the other school teams, do they get support from the schools themselves, or are they all like you, like hand to mouth and trying to raise money to go to tournaments and this and that sort of thing?
Oh, they're also trying to raise money on their own. They're trying to raise money. But there's a difference between some schools and our school.
Well, sure.
Fact that I believe that our school has a lot of talented kids, and the talent, if you only try to polish those raw talents, we'll be able to see the potential in them. So I try to polish those talents in my own way. So I'd say that if only there's an opportunity for everyone to see beyond, we'll be able to produce more talented kids, more champions.
When you talk to teachers, your colleagues or other chess coaches from other schools, I mean, do you get the sense that if there was a real effort put forward to institutionalize chess as one of the extracurriculars in CPS, that you could have many, many more chess teams than you have now? I mean, is there more demand, and do you think there would be more interest if there were resources devoted to supporting these teams?
Yes, I have colleagues who have been very supportive, and financially, they would not be able to come up with the money, but they have been very supportive to us and be able to talk with the kids. CPS also has it's a tie-up with the foundation, trying to help. But considering the population of the students, it's sort of limited in providing that help. So in my own way, I try to find other resources for these kids to be able to compete. So it depends on the coach. If somehow he can see himself as trying to do beyond what he can provide for.
And you said your next tournament is in New York, and do you have a way to get there?
Not really. I've been trying to raise also some funds and trying to contact some.
And what do you need? What do you need to raise for airfare and lodging and food and stuff?
Or take a bus.
And you're not going to stay at the Plaza if you get to Brooklyn. You know, if you get to New York, right? I mean, it's going to be reasonable.
They have to go to Central
Park. Yeah, no. Actually, we just need some food for them.
Oh, just food.
I was able to raise something for their airfare. It's just that we need a little more just for the food.
All right. Well,
how many days are you going to be there?
We'll make sure you get the money for the food so you guys can go. It's coming up. It's like nine days away, right? Yeah.
Oh, it will be next week. We hope to compete.
All right. We'll get the food
covered.
How
many kids do we have to feed?
So you go.
I'll be bringing about 8 kids. They're all excited. Never in their wildest dreams, that they say they will be able to see New York. But I just want them to, experience this thing that they will never forget for the rest of their lives. So I guess you and Dan, you and your friends have made an impact on them, positive impact on their lives.
Well,
so I want,
no,
in behalf of
you're the one
kids,
making you're
I want
the
to
one making
you.
You're the
you.
The one making the impact. Now, look, we'll get you the food money, but you know, no, like, not Le Cirque. It's not going to be Le Cirque. It's not going to, right. We're not, no Michelin rated, but we'll get you the food money. All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan.
All right. He is Joseph O'Call, math and algebra teacher, Ella Flagg Young Elementary on the West Side, and also chess coach and combination of the two. Joseph O'Call, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Blessings always. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, the April inflation numbers are out. U.S. inflation easing slightly in April to an 8.3% annual rate. Well, the big guy told you yesterday that his policies are working.
Do you take any responsibility for your policies?
I think our policies help, not hurt. Think about what they say. The vast majority of the economists think that this is going to be a real tough problem to solve. But it's not because of spending. We brought down the deficit. The bottom line is, how much does America owe? How much in the hole are we going? We're reducing that.
Yeah, it's working. I love this story. Bloomberg News had it. Right. A Mexican restaurant in Miami in the East Little Havana district. On the menu, they have stickers next to the items where they're just writing in the prices so they can put a new sticker on and put a new price on, because that's how quickly inflation is, and the inflation is increasing, and thus the prices are changing in order to stay in business.
That's Paul Vallis, when he filled in for you, his family has, you know, they're Greek, so they had a Greek restaurant. And during the 80s, during the Carter administration,
because every
that's
Greek
what they
has,
had to do.
Because every Greek has a Greek restaurant.
Yeah, I'm not going to get in trouble now
for
saying that.
No,
but
true.
I'm just saying that they, during the 80s, with Jimmy Carter, they had to do the same thing. They had to put little stickers on. Biden also, though, says he's not to blame, Dan, for prices that have been skyrocketing for more than a year by taking aim at the MAGA movement and the allies.
The MAGA Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress, which they've done everything they can to slow down. that you're going to will hand power over to them.
So that means what? So that you did get us here? Like those stickers on gas pumps? You did do that?
I did that. He did that.
Uh-huh. It's Putin and the MAGA Republicans, and Biden's policies are working. And look, inflation easing down to 8.3%, if you believe that number, which I don't. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, economist, author of Trumponomics, and more recently, GovZilla. Steve, thanks for joining us. The big guy's policies are working. The April numbers prove it. We're unwinding.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's just going swimmingly, isn't it? Look, that speech yesterday was just dreadful, really a dreadful speech in every way. I mean, one is that this is the president of the United States, and all he does is point fingers at everyone else but himself. You know, it's Putin, it's COVID, it's Trump, it's MAGA, it's all these things, you know. And when he came into office, the inflation rate was 1.5%, and we got some slight good news this morning that the inflation rate is now down from 8.5 to 8.3%. I guess we're supposed to celebrate that. But when he says he's bringing the deficit down, I mean, what planet is he living on? This is the guy who came in and the first thing he did was spend $3 trillion. You know, we had the $1.9 trillion, what they call it, the Recovery Act, and then the $1.1 trillion sham infrastructure bill, and it goes on and on. He just said last week he wants $1.5 trillion for student loan relief. He wants $30 billion unpaid for to send to Ukraine. I mean, I could go on and on with right. this stuff. He wants more. And by the way, that speech he gave yesterday was basically just endorsing the Build Back Better bill with more and more spending for solar. I mean, does anybody think that windmills are going to solve our inflation problem or even electric vehicles? Yeah, maybe in the year 2045, but this is 2022.
Well, and he made that speech yesterday while I was speaking, gas prices hit an all-time record high.
Exactly. And by the way, I was thinking of you, Amy, the other day because I've been on the road, speaking. I've been to about 5 states in the last couple of weeks. And when I say, oh, you know, we have this 8% inflation problem, people get angry at me. They say, 8%? What are you talking about? My gas price is up 80%. My food prices are up 35%. You know, my travel costs are up 40%. The things that people have to buy every day aren't going at 8%, much higher than that. So I don't think a lot of people even believe these numbers. And you've been talking about how frustrated you are, you know, when you go to the store. Yes. And I think that's universal.
Well, it's going to be, I mean, diesel fuel is up almost $6 a gallon, and that's how our goods are delivered. So they're going to have to pass that on to the consumer.
You better believe it. And then you've got Biden saying that he is going to solve this by more. Essentially, he said more government spending and higher taxes. And incidentally, yeah, where did this line come from that the Republicans want this massive tax increase on the middle class?
This is the bastardization of what's in the Rick Scott plan that was promulgated.
Oh, right. Well, Rick Scott said everybody should pay a little tax or something.
Right.
Oh, that means that, you know, but yeah. Meanwhile, we want to make the Trump tax cuts permanent. And Biden called for a big tax increase on quote, the rich, because the top 1% are going to pay for all this. They're going to reduce our $30 trillion debt. Right.
Well, you know, as the big guy famously said with the shovel-ready projects in 2009, we have to keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt. And so apparently that's still his philosophy.
Well, you know, the first step of a recovery is to admit you've got a problem, right? I mean, everyone knows that. Anyone who knows someone with an addiction problem, the first step is you got to say, okay, yeah, I have a drinking problem or I have a drug problem. We have a drug problem in Washington, and the crack cocaine is overspending. And Biden's speech, oh, there's no spending problem. You know, we're lean. You know, he's a fiscal conservative. Did you know that? He wants to cut spending as he's calling for trillions more.
The global economy and its potential impact on America as we're looking at, you know, as we continue to kick around this notion that we could go into recession as soon as this year. Your Wall Street Journal reporting this week that President Xi there in China is scrambling as China's economy is stumbling with projections that it will grow less than 4% by some economists. He's got all kinds of problems in his tech sector, property sector, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and not to mention with lockdowns of 30 million people in Shanghai. So how much of what is happening in China should we expect to be visited upon what's happening here?
Well, first of all, I mean, what's going on in China right now, it's not really being widely reported by the American media, but this is one of the most cruel and inhumane policies, where literally people are starving to death in their apartments because the Chinese have, in Shanghai, which is a town of 25 million. How many people live in the Chicago? About 6 million or so.
Shanghai is what, 26 million?
So Shanghai is like 4 times bigger than even Chicago. And it's in total lockdown. They won't let people out of their houses. They won't let people out of the factories. I mean, it's incredibly militant. You know, it's almost like they've got Fauci running their program.
It's worse than that.
Slowed down. What's that?
I'm sorry, Fenner. It's worse than that. This morning, disinfectant teams are going door to door in Shanghai and entering homes of corona and virus infected people to spray the disinfectant because they think that's going to stop the spread.
Yeah, well, that's what they're going to do here if we allow them to do it. But my point is that China economy has really slowed considerably, and it is contributing down to the supply chain problems. I'll give you an example. My wife and I went out last weekend to look at maybe buying a new car because we got about 180,000 miles on our car we have now. But we went to about 4 showrooms. Sure, we can get you a car in 4 months.
Right.
So,
I mean, they have nothing. And the show, every car that they had already been sold. And they said, we can't get the chips from China. And so that's a big problem, Dan. No question.
Now, did you come up with this for the Journal editorial board? President Costanza takes on inflation. Did you come up with the Seinfeld reference to characterize Biden?
I have to say my former boss, Paul Chagall, runs the Journal editorial page. He's a big Seinfeld guy.
There you go.
He loved to use those references. But it was perfect, right? It's everything that Biden proposed yesterday was exactly the opposite of what we need to do, right? He called for more taxes, more spending, more regulation, more green subsidies. No, we need less of that. We need to be just producing American oil and gas and stop the spending. I mean, if I were advising Biden, which I'm not, I'd tell the first thing you gotta do is cut every government spending program by about 10%. Let's just do that right now and suck some of that excess money out of the economy. He was the opposite, by the way, Biden, of Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, gave speeches all the time about, if you want to get inflation down, you got to cut government spending. And Biden's saying just the opposite. And sorry, I'm with Milton Friedman on that one, Dan.
Let's talk about small businesses looking for workers and not being able to find them. Again, last week, the NFIB survey had 48% of small businesses wanting to hire, can't find people to hire. And this is like two and a quarter times its historic average, nearly half these businesses. Yeah. I was talking to a guy who has a cleaning business, commercial cleaning business, and he and his wife now are doing most of the cleaning because it's so difficult to find people that want to work that for his business. And it's really taxing the business, and he's losing business as a result of the labor shortage. What is your message for the small business owner operators and the labor supply in the near term? Do you see any improvement in the near term?
We're still providing so much money to people for not working, and so it's really hard for these employers. Right now there's 10 million open jobs, but, I suspect that number is going to come down pretty radically. I mean, look, the other story we didn't talk about, Dan, is the stock market has crashed.
Yeah.
I mean, the losses have been in the $5 to $8 trillion mark. There's going to be a reverse wealth effect. People aren't going to have the money now. And so I think that problem that we're talking about now of too few workers, that could turn around pretty radically, and you could have too few jobs. We're skating on the verge of a recession again. Last quarter was negative 1.4%. Right now, the latest forecast for this quarter about positive 1 to 2%. But that's, you get 2 quarters of negative GDP, you're in recession officially. The economy is slowing down big time right now, and there's just no leadership in Washington. And the other thing, I'm so frustrated because I really honestly believe, and look, I'm biased. I work for Trump. I was one of his economic advisors. But if Trump were president today, the economy would be booming. It should be booming. COVID is over. People are going back to work. Restaurants are open. Stores are open. We're getting back to normal. People are going back to movie theaters, cruise ships. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. People are taking cruises again. The economy is ready to roar. It is all these government policies that are just crushing the economy right now.
He is Steve Moore, economist, Trumponomics, and Govzilla author. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys, have a great week. Take care.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Anna Wisner's daughter struggled in school until she was admitted to Lionsgate Academy in Minnetonka, Minnesota. It's a charter school there that specializes in serving children on the autism spectrum, grade 7 through 12. Now, according to mom, her daughter thinks about her future. She talks about getting a job and living on her own. In D.C., they're trying to end such opportunities for families like the Wisners. The Lionsgate Academy Charter School got started and has since expanded through grants from the Charter School Program, which is a federal fund that supports new charters and those looking to expand. But in March of this year, the DOE, Department of Education, put forward new rules requiring charter operators to submit community impact analysis that is identitary in nature, as you would anticipate. And so it threatens, and this is teachers union backed, for the purposes of defunding charter schools. Now, charter schools are an imperfect alternative to government schools in and of themselves. If you want a true choice environment, then you really need to get to opportunity scholarships, put resources in the hands of families, not schools. The McKay Scholarship Program in Florida is a better model than relying on central planners to properly central plan. McKay Scholarship is where parents receive the resources, parents with children who have special needs, parents receive the resources, and they make spend decisions. That's the better model. But charter schools, as I've often said, nice way station to a more fully developed school choice environment. Nonetheless, again, they're trying to get through the back door what they can't get through the front door. I'm talking about these teachers union-backed politicians like the big guy in this administration. Naomi Schaefer Riley, American Enterprise Institute scholar, writes about this in the Wall Street Journal. She writes, how would schools like Lionsgate be able to describe their potential impact on the racial makeup of feeder schools? Lionsgate draws from more than 40 districts and admits students by lottery. It's shocking the education department would deny autistic children a good education in the name of preventing change in the racial makeup of other schools. But that's exactly what they aim to do, because it is not about best outcomes for children. It's about the convenience and benefit and control of the adults inside these institutions, as we have seen for generations in places like the Chicago public school system. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Tony Kinnett, executive director of the heterodox education publication Chalkboard Review, former STEM coordinator and head instructional coach for the Indianapolis Public Schools, our neighbors to the east there. Oh. Tony, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on this morning, guys.
So I know, I referenced your op-ed last week with respect to, you know, progressive policies in the classroom. We've talked about a number of them, not just curricula, but also the safety environment and the air of quote unquote restorative justice approach to discipline in the schools. But even pulling back outside of the classroom and to how the systems are set up, as we're talking about with charter schools and the effort by the teachers union at every level, including the federal, to stifle competition.
It's incredible to look at how the different parts moving in the last couple of years have made every effort possible to squash free market accountability, in which a parent should be able to decide the kind of discipline environment for their child or the kind of academic environment, or as we were just talking about, the special education services for that child. But instead, the federal government has intervened, as you said, at the behest of teachers unions to pursue racial quotas, which has not worked out very well for Harvard, by the way. The lawsuits are growing into the dozens.
And it seems to me that the teachers unions are on the losing side of this fight. That's the good news, particularly coming out of the pandemic. And what you're seeing at the state level, where you've seen, including your home state there of Indiana, where you've seen school choice programs either launched or significantly expanded, and they're producing results, and that's the best play. That's why they try to stop them, is because when they produce results and when they build constituencies based on beneficiaries, it's very difficult to unwind them, and that's what's actually happening at the state level in so many states.
Oh, it's the truth. I actually wrote a report at the beginning of last school year when I was still employed at Indianapolis Public Schools, citing this mass exodus from public schools all across Indiana to various public, private, parochial, charter, micro, and home options that were just out of these big public school settings, and even some of the bigger private schools that act in the same way. Socially, there's just this huge movement out of these failing environments. And that was a report that I wrote at the beginning of last year. All of those numbers have almost doubled in both projections for next year and in mid-semester and mid-year pullouts. So the education environment is definitely shifting and doing so very quickly. No wonder the union is freaking out and throwing more radical policies at the playbook.
What was the final straw for you, where you're like, I've had enough?
There were a lot of smaller final straws that kind of linked together. But I've studied critical race theory at the graduate level for 8 years, mm-hmm. Which is interesting because I've been told recently several times that it doesn't exist. So it's amazing, you know, something you spent the better part of a decade studying doesn't exist. Well, one of the professors that I sat under, Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings, came to Indianapolis and gave this racial equity demonstration presentation and was mocking the parents that I had been told to lie to and say we weren't using any kind of critical race theory or any other kind of hyper-progressive ideology in our classrooms. She was mocking our parents and saying that they were assets of a racial and racist pandemic. That's just too much. I mean, being asked to lie is terrible. Being asked to lie to parents is worse. But then having the district openly mock those parents after I'd just been told to lie, that's too much. I mean, that's doubling and tripling down on just very poor character.
Yeah, I go back to, since you brought up critical theory and critical race theory specifically, one of the greatest descriptions I've heard of conflict theory, because it's so ubiquitous now, was from Alana Redstone, who's a sociology professor at U of I, University of Illinois. She wrote a piece in at the Tablet, Conflict Theory Doesn't Like You. And she writes, conflict theory, and by extension, critical race theory and intersectional theory, looks into the room of social problems and shines a giant spotlight on a single aspect of the human condition, yet leaves the rest of the room dark. And she goes on to say, with the light of insight shining on this one spot, we're led to believe that all matters for understanding human misery is recognizing the endless struggle for power between oppressor and the oppressed. But where does that leave everything else that makes up the human experience? And those race hustlers and intersectional theorists, also hustlers, they don't have an answer for that question.
Well, because there's not supposed to be an answer. So Pablo Ferrer actually based some of his, you know, essential writings in Pedagogy of the Oppressed from his looking north to the United States and some of the writings of Derrick Bell, who wrote on the permanence of racism, you know, the faces at the bottom of the well. And the idea was that there's always going to be this eternal struggle between the minority and the majority, or different minority groups and the majority. So therefore, you have an obligation to always side with the minority. And that's some type of eternal righteousness. It's very religious in a way, actually. It was criticized. A lot of Paolo's writings were criticized by even some of the secular thinkers in the 90s because the writings were so faith-based. You just have to believe it's righteous. You just have to believe that it's good, because there's no reward. There's no payout. There is no peace at the end of the tunnel. It's an eternal struggle for the minority, just because, as you said, it's boiled down to one specific factor. And in the case of critical race theory, that's color. In intersectionality, it's color and gender and sexual preference. It's a whole inherent characteristic mess.
How do we measure the impact that it's having? I mean, it's all anecdotal. It's, you know, it's sort of visceral, too, in terms of understanding, like, promoting neo-segregation. That doesn't sound right. That doesn't seem like a sensible thing to do. But, you know, it seems to me by the time we sort of try to measure the academic impact and the socio-cultural impact of the curricula that is being inculcated in so many K-12 systems, you know, it'll be too late. And I guess that's sort of the point.
I'm not sure that I agree that all of the evidence is anecdotal, because you can actually track what they claim is going to be the effect of these policies on schools by how the schools have turned out. So this is not new for inner city schools. This was Gloria Ladson-Billings' answer to inner city fatherlessness and intergenerational poverty in the 90s. So when she started implementing, I mean, there were literally episodes in Bill Cosby that referenced this curriculum. She was actually cited on one of those early episodes, which is just kind of a fun little tidbit piece of trivia. But they applied these programs in schools, and the schools didn't get better. They got worse. And then the other schools that didn't try that, they got better. That is a very specific quantitative data metric. What you tried did not work.
Mm-hmm.
What you said was going to happen, the harmony that you thought you were going to bring forward. Thomas Sowell points this out in regard to the multicultural push in the 80s and 90s. He said there, you know, we're suggesting that if we just include Spanish classes in early elementary grades, then everything is going to be great. And it wasn't. It didn't work, because it didn't produce the results. It was focused on the color and very small arbitrary factors that don't matter. And so that's how we measure it doesn't work. Everything else, all of the social unrest, is just icing on the horrible cake.
Yeah, I mean, no, I guess there, yeah, there are metrics. I mean, there's metrics. There's a recent, of all places, Department of Education report on sort of normalizing test scores of 2019 high school grads versus 2009 high school grads. And then when they find, when you really dig into it, that what appeared to be better GPAs and better preparedness for college actually wasn't. So
right. It's a metric of almost 30% decline. It's like an inflation almost.
But I guess, you know, to what did and didn't work, then the response always from that set is more money for schools, more money for schools. And the parents are sort of socialized, more money for schools, more money for schools. And both parties do that in a lot of places. And so maybe there is no metric, but it doesn't seem like the evidence that we have is changing how we operate K through 12, with the exception of these school choice programs that are afoot, but not the government systems. Those are impervious to change.
Right. I mean, you actually can see the effects of the whole more money from schools argument play out in the late 90s and the early aughts in California, who some public schools had their annual budgets doubled or tripled, and the grades didn't go up at all. Not even like 3 to 5%, where you could say, well, we're just not getting our bang for our buck. The scores didn't increase. In fact, a lot of teachers' salaries didn't increase. That's what we're seeing in Indiana. People are currently very upset because there was a budget surplus in Indiana. I know that you guys are kind of unfamiliar with the idea in Illinois.
I've heard about these
things.
Word. Yeah, no, right.
It's very foreign. How do you pronounce it?
We took some of the surplus, I think. It's not all that common for us either, but we gave some of that money to schools. And some of the schools are giving their teachers a raise. And some of them are refinishing their high school basketball gymnasiums for the third time in the last 50 years. So what people are starting to come to terms with is that the amount of money the school is given is not really a decent metric for school performance. It's who the teachers are that are hired, and then how those teachers are taken care of. And then, of course, how those students are held responsible behaviorally, as you guys cited in my op-ed from last week.
Speaking of behaviorally, we have this this high-profile case out of a suburban high school here, where a black female sophomore issued a real beating of a white freshman girl, and she's been charged with misdemeanor battery, and her friend who filmed has been charged with misdemeanor disorderly conduct. The school is very hush hush. They have a DAI coordinator who's paid $150,000. They're doing all this restorative justice stuff. They've got all these workshops. In fact, after this beating occurred in the hallways at school, they had a bunch of workshops about colonialism and racism and anti-racism and restore, you know, all the usual lineup. And so, but what we find is from some, again, the research here, is that when you embark on this restorative justice where we're not going to do suspensions and expulsions because it disproportionately impacts minorities, so the argument goes, and so we're just going to do timeouts and warnings and so on and so forth. So the schools become less safe. So now you have the combination of schools becoming less safe as well as declining in terms of academic performance, in terms of the students' academic performance. It's a nice twofer at quite a number in terms of price, as we've seen it escalate over the last 50 years, the amount of money we spend per pupil.
And, you know, other than the fact that it's very clear, and I actually made this criticism of Superintendent Johnson in Indianapolis, and I was still actually employed at the district, and HR department was very upset I had said this on the radio, that I believed one of the reasons that Indianapolis was utilizing these restorative justice practices, certainly not to the extent that many of the Northern Illinois schools had been doing so, but I believed that the reason that she, and still do believe, the reason that she had implemented those was so that more students of color would stay in the district and would therefore allow the district to collect more money on property taxes. And that was evidenced by one particular high school having requested 9 exceptionally violent students be expelled. And this principal is not like your traditional conservative would expel any violent student. I mean, very, very, very to the left principal who recommended these students for expulsions. So they have to be well-deserved at that point. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And she had turned, and the superintendent had turned every one of those requests down. Every one of them, the students were ordered to be put back in classrooms. And I look at these things and I'm bewildered that we're doing all of this for a few thousand extra dollars when some of these districts are, I mean, seriously, are swimming in cash. And yet they're going to whine about the horrors of the student who just smashed another student's skull into a locker being removed from the school. Instead, they think that the $2,000, the $3,000 is worth sitting the abuser next to the abused. And it's horrific.
But it isn't also about race. I mean, I don't know in that particular case you're referencing if there was a racial disparity.
But it's insulting, though.
Well, I know.
I mean,
But I mean, if you have a DAI coordinator at your school, then everything is going to be about race. That's basically signaling it's going to be about race.
Oh, absolutely. And these kind of condescending remarks that come from, as you call them, DAI coordinators are so incredible, suggesting that, you know, punishing violent behavior is going to negatively impact Black students is a very fancy collegiate way of saying, I expect that Black students are going to be more violent than white students.
Right.
What a horrible thing to insinuate. And any parent that heard something like that, and this is something we've seen with our work at Chalkboard Review, when we share a lot of these statements with parents in Indianapolis and we've also with Milwaukee and several other communities of parents across the nation, a lot of parents' first reaction is lawsuit. And even that are, again, very far to the left and really don't have any interest in me personally, their second reaction is to get their kids out of these schools as quickly as possible because they don't want their kids held to lower standards like they're animals.
Absolutely. Tony Kinnett, executive director of the heterodox education publication Chalkboard Review, former STEM coordinator and head instructional coach for Indianapolis Public Schools. Tony, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Newly minted Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. She apparently part of that revolving door between the big guys administration and MSNBC, and just sort of generally speaking, the D.C. press corps and the upper reaches of government, particularly on the Dem Socialist side. Okay. Well, she was on MSNBC back in March 15th of 2020 in particular, on many times, but this appearance, one we're focusing in on because it informs how she'll do her job as press secretary, specifically as it pertains to Fox News. And take a listen and you'll understand why.
Was racist before coronavirus. They are racist during the coronavirus. Fox News will be racist after the coronavirus. So there is nothing new here. I think the difference is they have been, they are all in on being state TV for Donald Trump. And so they will continue to give them misinformation. The danger is, so yes, you have Asian Americans right now whose lives are seriously in danger. And you have their own viewers who can now, the ones who are 60 and older who are watching. This is a health crisis that we're in. This is a global pandemic, as the WHO has said, and they're putting their lives in danger. And so that is where we are right now, is the danger that Fox News is now, what they're putting out there is going to hurt people and not help.
Right. So Fox News is racist. They've always been racist. They'll always be racist. We got that. And then they were also hurting, if not killing people outright during the pandemic. Should be some interesting exchanges between her and Peter Ducey coming up. But I know what she's going to do. I know what the response is going to be. We've heard it before. Here's what the response is going to be. That was when I was an advocate. I was an advocate then. Now I'm donning a new hat and I am press secretary. Where have we heard this before? Most recently and most entertainingly, in a Senate confirmation hearing, Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, with respect to a federal judge, a federal judicial nominee from the Biden administration, her name, Nusrat Jahan Chaudhry. She's the first Muslim woman to be nominated to serve on the federal bench. And that wasn't what Senator Kennedy wanted to talk to her about. He wanted to talk to her about her views on police. Listen to this exchange and make sure you understand how it will inform what you hear from KJP as the press secretary and the left's posture generally.
This is a really simple question, Counselor. Do you believe that cops kill unarmed black men in America every single day? You said it at Princeton.
Senator, I said it in my role as an advocate.
Oh, okay. You didn't mean it.
Senator, I said it in my role as an advocate to make a rhetorical point.
So when you say something that's incorrect, it's okay to excuse it by saying, oh, I was being an advocate? What do you believe? Do you personally believe that cops kill unarmed black men every single day in America?
Senator, I believe law enforcement have an important and challenging job in this country.
That's not what you said, though, counsel.
Senator, I say before you here today that I do believe law enforcement have a difficult and challenging job, and I also understand the difference
I just think that's an extraordinary statement to make with no data to back up. No, none whatsoever. There's no basis for you saying that. And you knew it then and you know it now. How can one possibly believe that you're going to be unbiased on the federal bench?
Senator, I believe my record shows that I have worked collaboratively with law enforcement in Boston, Chicago, Mississippi, and Milwaukee to solve complex problems to promote constitutional, effective, and safe
policing. Your record shows that you believe cops are guilty until proven innocent. Your record shows that if a cop shoots a criminal, it's the cop's fault. And if a criminal shoots a cop, it's the gun's fault. I've read your record, Ms. Murrah, and I don't appreciate you not answering the question straight up. I would respect you a lot more if you'd just tell us what you believe and not try to hide it.
It was such a classic example of something that our next guest has written about recently, the information shaping that goes on in the upper reaches of government and culture in this country. Cheryl Atkison is an investigative journalist, Emmy Award-winning host of Full Measure, the author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, if you're an advocate or when you're an advocate, you can say anything and get away with it. That's the posture of the left. If you have to get confirmed by the Senate, if you have to take questions from Republicans, if you have to take questions from a reporter for Fox News, well, then you just sort of wall that portion of who you are off and you pretend like you can be unbiased on the bench, or you pretend like you'll give Fox News a fair shake as a information gatekeeper for the White House.
You know, to even treat that on any level like it makes any sort of sense is ridiculous. It's classic, I guess you would call it doublespeak from 1984, to say that we know how they felt, we know what they said, and we are to believe now that something has changed and something is different. But this is, you know, this is pretty classic that we have these people, and I guess you could argue there are people on all sides of the political spectrum, but the ones in charge now say deranged things, false and inaccurate things, and disinformation. And then when they need to, they try to have us believe by saying something quite the opposite, that we didn't hear what we heard, or we shouldn't think what we think about it.
Well, and they also don the cloak of the misinformation minder. We're going to erect a board to monitor misinformation and disinformation because we're so concerned about the truth.
Well, that's, I think, the most dangerous development we've heard in recent months. The notion that the government, and I'm not a constitutional expert, but I feel common sense-wise, this must be unconstitutional on its face. The government steps in to censor or tell people what they can and should see and think and read, which is exactly what they want to do. And I see them forming their Ministry of Disinformation or their Ministry of Truth much as a desperate and knee-jerk response to losing Twitter. It almost confirms that they were using Twitter, as we all know, as a way to shape and control information so that the message people get when they go online every day is largely one that's approved by certain people, that you can't have discussions that are outside the line, to give the false impression that a majority of people feel a certain way when they don't, so that other discussions can't be had. That's been the game, and the prospect of losing that control, I guess, prompted them to make this ridiculous federal agency that should be stopped before it even starts. I don't even understand, you know, I don't know what one would have to do to prevent this from happening, but it just seems to be unconstitutional and illegal on its face.
Are you looking forward to Elon Musk taking over Twitter? Because yesterday you said it was morally wrong and flat out stupid to take President Trump off of Twitter.
Well, I am. And, you know, I've said since all this stuff started being discussed that Elon Musk is to big tech what Donald Trump is to politics. They have real grassroots support. They represent a huge swath of the public that doesn't have a voice or that is prevented from speaking out or told that they can't. And that's very powerful once it finally organizes. You know, I've said that the propagandists who control a lot of our information, they're well-funded and they're well-organized. The grassroots response, which is actually probably the majority of the public, takes longer. It's not so well-funded. It's not organized at first glance. But what we're seeing now is people are fighting back. It took some time. It's taken a couple of years for people to muster up and see what they can do so that the majority of people are not controlled by radical fringe notions. And I think we're in that battle right now, and Elon Musk is part of it. I look forward to seeing what happens.
Well, and this battle is so mission critical because the landscape is such that when people make references to 1984, you know, you're thinking of just Big Brother, but it's not just the public sector. As we know, you have all of the cultural institutions that have folded in or are in the process of folding in with the state. I mean, we saw that in a pronounced way during the pandemic. And so, I mean, you really are on a dangerous path now where you have Fortune 500, D.C. press corps, the entertainment and the arts, the most powerful agencies in the federal government that are responsible for law enforcement, like DOJ and FBI, all folding into this approach to a formerly free society.
Well, we are in a crisis state. Because I think people are starting to see that, and I hear people talk about this, that they're recognizing it, something I wrote about, gosh, at least 10 years ago, that all of our institutions are being co-opted by similar powers and controls. The internet made it easy in some ways for these powerful interests to control us because so many people rely on their information from either social media or internet searches or Google or YouTube, that if they just can control that box, which they've largely successfully done, meaning very few political and corporate interests, then they pretty much control, you know, 80% of what we can get and see. That made it easy because that's where we get our information. But they've also infiltrated, as people understand, our federal agencies, our congressional and elected offices, the media, as everybody knows. I mean, we joke, not in a humorous way, but we joke about it, that almost every media organization we assume has been what we say infiltrated with interests who will stop certain stories, whether it's pharmaceutical or certain political stories. And then you go on, the courts, people don't trust the courts and the Department of Justice, certain law enforcement bodies. Nobody feels that they are just freely operating entities of power anymore in this country. And, you know, at its root, it's turning out that they think we work for them instead of understanding that these are public servants and elected officials who work for us. The tables have been turned. And I think people are starting to see that and respond to it.
Yes, the vassals revolt, revolting, which we'll see if that happens again in November. Cheryl Atkinson, investigative journalist, Emmy Award-winning host of Full Measure, author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks to you.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.